What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hello again, peoples of the internet. Thanks for tuning in to Riff Raff. You know, what is it about Texas? The cliche, something in the water, definitely applies to this place, man. I mean, think about all the great guitar players that have come from Texas. Like, a lot of great musicians, period, but guitar players, I mean, Billy Gibbons, Eric Johnson, Stevie Ray Vaughan. Here you have Jimmy Vaughan. I don't know. There's a lot of other people that I'm sure I'm leaving out, but one at the top of that list is David Grissom. You know, David's a really versatile, eclectic player. He's got a great style. He's known for getting killer guitar tones. He's also a composer. He's written a lot of songs for people, too. Does sessions. And known him for a long time. I was happy to get him on the podcast, and he was more than happy to do it. So I think you'll enjoy this one. Let's see, it was a day in Austin, and I got up early in the morning and met David at his house. He was so accommodating, and these are getting earlier and earlier, it seems. I'm just trying to pull these off, spur of the moment. But in this one, we talk about a lot of cool things. He talks about John Cougar, who he played with for a long time. And he talks about Joe Ely. That was like one of his first gigs when he got to Austin. I didn't know he played with Lucinda Williams, too. He talks about that. A lot of good things. I won't give it away yet. But thanks again for your comments. Seems like actually a lot of you guys are listening, because I keep getting more and more comments and reviews, which is really great. It keeps inspiring me to make more. I talked to Sonny Landreth this morning. I think he's going to be the next guest. So I'm hoping to pull that off. Yeah, I'll keep making them as long as you guys keep listening. So enjoy. This one has a little bonus material at the end. There's a thing where I plugged into David's one of his rigs, and he goes through his pedal board while I'm playing, and he just kind of hits little pedals. I was testing stuff out. It's kind of neat. I didn't want to throw it away, so it's going to be on the end, the very end, if you want to check that out. All right, so it was a fairly early morning for a musician in Austin, and walk up to David's driveway into his studio. Beautiful spot. It's got some great guitars, all kinds of stuff, killer amps and things. I plug into an old Tweed Deluxe of his through his pedal board, and he plugs into another rig into his PRS amp. He's got another Marshall setup too. And we just take it off, man. I start playing this little riff. I tried to pan myself to the right, and he's on the left, but you'll hear him coming a mile away. Hope you enjoy.
Riff, 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 riff.
I want to hear you play. I don't want to play. I want to hear you play.
Oh, no, I want to hear you.
Man.
Been a long time.
It's been a long time. All right. I am sitting here in Austin, Texas with David Grissom. Man, it has been a long time. And thanks for making the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. I mean, I have to say that the idea of us sitting down and playing guitars at 10:30 in the morning is sort of a very foreign idea 10 years ago.
Right? But it's kind of still nice a foreign idea, but you have to take it while you can get it.
Yeah.
So, but it's fun. It's a good way to get your blood pumping in the morning.
It's great to see you.
Great to see you, man. Looking great. You know, I saw you. When was it? We were just talking about 2 years ago in Montana.
We sort of passed in the night.
It was really brief. We didn't really get to chat, but I want to tell the listeners, I first met you, gosh, what was it, late 90s? We were touring together.
B.B. King Blues Festival.
B.B. King, you were with Storyville. We probably did
5 weeks.
Shows together.
Probably five nights a week, at least.
Yeah, it seems like a lifetime ago.
I know.
It really does. I have a picture of us together back then, because I was a fan of yours, and I remember... All of a sudden, we're like in catering together. And I go, wow, man, Dave, because that was my first real touring gig, you know, where we, like, all of a sudden I was with people that I looked up to, you know, and I remember hanging with you.
It was Neville's, BB, Dr. John, and Storyville.
Storyville, yeah. That was a great band, man.
It was a good band. We were sort of before our time in a way, and not necessarily groundbreaking musically, but. We did a reunion gig in 2006 and did a live DVD, and I think we sold more copies of that DVD than we ever did of any of our records. I mean, it still sells. It's crazy. And like half of the email I get is, why don't you put Storyville back together? And I'm like, God, I want to move forward, you know? where were you guys? I'm like, you know, I mean, it's a great band, but that was then, this is now.
Yeah.
One of the funniest memories I have of that tour is we played some gig, I don't remember where it was, but it was just like, you know, one of the smaller venues outdoors, and the stage was really small, and everything was real self-contained, and we finished our set, and Dr. John came up and just goes, you guys are way too loud.
He said
way
that?
Way too loud.
Really?
Yeah, Dr. John, I'm like, oh, man, I was crushed, you know.
He must have been joking, man. He wouldn't say anything like that.
I think he was serious. He said, too damn loud. Too damn loud, yeah.
That's funny, man.
But... Other than that, it was a blast. I got BB, you know, actually got BB to sign a 335 I was playing at the time. And, I was, you know, probably one of the three or four times in my life I've been starstruck.
Yeah, we got to hear BB every night. Mm. Every night.
Yeah.
And I got to hear you every night. It was fun, man. God, I don't even know where to start. Going back to Storyville. That was a real band thing for you. Like, you put all your eggs in that basket for a while, because I remember you telling me, man, I turned down a Rod Stewart tour to do this.
You got a good memory.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah, I did. I did 3 years with John Mellencamp, which was alternated between, like, one of the greatest experiences in my life to one of the absolute worst experiences in my life. You never knew which day.
I want to hear about it.
You never knew what it was going to be until the day got going. But at the end of the day, it was an invaluable, great experience. Everybody in the band was so cool. It was an honor to play with those guys. But I have to say that, you know, at the end of that 3 year period, I went out and did 3 weeks with the Allman Brothers, when filling in for Dickie Betts. And by the time we got done with that 3 weeks, I kind of remembered, oh, this is what I love about music. And, you know, had gotten away from, even though we made some cool records and every day I learned something working with John. I kind of had gotten away from that spirit of just the joy of playing music and improvising. Mm-hmm. And, so I got back, and I just sort of, you know, John would probably say I got fired. I say that I quit. It doesn't matter. And then, like, right after that, Jeff Golub, who I'd become friends with when I was playing with Ely, called and said, hey, man, I'm leaving Rod Stewart. The gig is yours if you want. I mean, I can recommend you, and I'm pretty sure you got the gig. And it was more money than I was making with John. And at the very same time, Chris Layton called me and said, hey, we're putting this band together. And it's me and Tommy, this singer named Malford. You need to go check him out. And another guitar player named David Holt. And so I had this kind of the T in the road, you know, which has been the theme of my whole music life, is there's constantly these crossroads you come to. And if you make the right decision, you keep moving in the right direction. And I just thought about it, and I thought, if I go to with Rod, it's going to be, I may be playing these country club rock tours for a long time, mm-hmm. but the Storyville thing was like, this could really be something. Yeah. I mean, this could be really special.
Right.
And it was the one time, I think, in my entire career where my wife told me I was, she thought I was crazy. But I went with my gut, and we spent the next 5 years driving a van back and forth across the country. We made two records, never got, you know, we had a song called Good Day for the Blues on our first record that got, it almost cracked into, you know, I think we sold maybe 100,000 copies of that record, which was pretty damn good. Nowadays, it would be incredible. But it just never caught on. And there's a lot of different, I could point to a lot of different reasons for that. But what I learned again, you know, I started writing songs, and it was grinding it out. It was really grinding it out. And kudos to Chris and Tommy, who came from, you know, Stevie, you know, and we were all in the trenches together. And even though we never got to any, you know, a particular level of success where we could sustain it, these choices that we make along the way have so much to do with longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And do we get to keep doing this? When I worked with Joe Ely from 85 till I went to Mellencamp, one of the greatest lessons I learned from him, just watching him, was his approach to everything he did, really. One of the most memorable nights I can remember is we were in the first European tour I ever did, ever, and with him. It was brutal. I mean, it was just like, you know, the middle of winter. We were driving around in a van that didn't have heat in it. And we got to someplace in Germany, and it was just like, the PA looked like it was a, you know, like a sure vocal master kind of thing. And our sound man cobbled it together to where it worked. And we go out and play, and there's like five people.
Wow.
And the bartenders. And it was the most intense performance Joe ever had. Yeah, I mean, it was the most, it was like he just went after it with a vengeance from the first moment to the end of the show. And I'm like, this is the real deal. It's like, you know, okay,
there's
I'm going to make these five people go tell all their friends. And so that, there were countless experiences like that. And then the musical things that I learned from Joe about dynamics, you know, how you can do within the course of a show and a set, you can play the quietest ballad in the world and still rock out. You know, I mean, The Clash was really influenced by Joe. And I mean, so just that breadth of dynamics and textures, and the level of songwriting,
mm-hmm.
and the songs he picked, the songs he wrote, and the choices he made, you know, not to take the easy, quick, you know, he was kind of, at one point he was on MCA, And he could have, you know, they were teeing him up to be the next Springsteen. And he just had a sense, and, you know, his intuition said, if I do this, I'm not being true to myself. Mm-hmm. And to this day, he's probably got the most, you know, he turned 70 last year, and he's probably working more than he ever did. And he's doing stuff that means something. And,
takes a lot of guts to be.
He's an artist, you know. I mean, that's what it takes. I mean, to follow your heart and not go for the. You know, it's like we got to pay our bills, but at the same time, it's like, do you want to grow? Do you want to?
You don't want to compensate this. One of the first times I ever saw you play was on Austin City Limits with Joe. Yeah, Joe Ailey. That was, and you were using like a Dr. Z, some, or maybe it was Red or something.
No, that was a 100-watt Marshall.
Was it?
A Red, like 70, 69. I had a Red 69 Super Lead.
That's a long time ago.
We were just talking about this earlier. How did we ever play that loud, you know?
Well, I just started playing loud. I didn't play loud back then.
Well, I didn't have a master volume in it, and I had it on 6 through a 412, and it was loud. But it was a good loud.
Yeah, it's warm. It's a warm.
A warm loud. And, I mean, sometimes those amps, if you dial them in right, don't seem as loud as like a super reverb, even because of the high end response.
I find that my Marshall, it's got more girth to it, and you don't have to actually be as loud, but it feels louder. The sensation of it takes up more space.
It's got so much bottom.
It's denser, and the chords and stuff just were fatter. You know?
Yeah.
Let's see. We're kind of skipping around, but that's cool. You're from Kentucky originally, right? I think you had told me that once. And what brought you to Austin? Because you're known as like, you know, Austin has this thing of the Austin gunslinger guitar thing, you know, and names pop up. It's always you, obviously Eric Johnson, Billy Gibbons, maybe David Holt. I'm missing some people, I'm sure, but
there's so many great guitar players in this town. And I came here because everything I was listening to was happening. I was listening to Ely.
Oh, so you were listening to
Ely big time, and Luann Barton, the Thunderbirds.
I forgot Stevie Vaughan. Yeah,
Stevie.
Get that.
And I ended up playing with Ely and Luann. Luann was my first. Well, actually, my first gig in Austin was Lucinda Williams before anybody knew who she was.
Wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know you worked with Lucinda.
Yeah, in fact, 2 weeks after I moved here, I kind of got that gig. I just called the writer at the Statesman, the paper here, which was like a really naive thing to do. I said, "Hey, man, I just moved here. I'm looking for a gig. Do you know anybody?" And he's like, "Well, I'm not a matchmaker, but if you're any good, I know this woman named Lucinda Williams, and she's looking for somebody. So here's her number."
Unbelievable.
I know. I mean, I would never do that today, and especially it's a guy named Ed Ward who's like really, you know, can be kind of he'd unfiltered and tell you the way it is.
So for all you guitar players wondering how to get gigs, call your local paper.
Don't do that. I don't recommend that at all. But you can relate to this. Like 2 weeks after I start playing with her, she's got a gig at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I mean, I've barely been out of Kentucky. You know, I drove down to Texas and I saw, you know, the mid-south or whatever, you know, Tennessee and everything.
Right.
So we load up and drive over there. We spend the night in Lake Charles at their friend's house that have a crawfish farm. And I mean, we ate between 10 of us, we ate about 80 pounds of crawfish.
Oh,
it was like, you know, till we couldn't walk, and then crawfish omelets the next morning. And
we get to
New Orleans, and we're in, you know, and staying in the quarter, and at our hotel, we got Richard Thompson. Grandmaster Flash and Roy Orbison.
What a
and
combination.
We're all hanging out, you know, the bands are all hanging at the pool. Well, Ed went with us, the critic, who happened to be a food critic too. So, like, every meal we're going to, like, Dookie Chase. We're going to places off the beaten path. And I mean, I was like, my life just changed. I mean, I can't even believe this is another planet.
Yeah.
You know, New Orleans, and especially the Jazz and Heritage Festival, as you know, back then was a much smaller
deal. I think it was more jazz, blues, and heritage than it is now, actually.
It was. Yeah. So that was magic. And that was, you know, with playing with Lucinda, then we got Derek O'Brien in the band as well. And then he got me in Lou Ann Barton's band. So all of a sudden I'm playing at Antone's two or three nights a week and I get in free and, you know, getting to meet Hubert Sumlin and Jimmy Rogers and Otis Rush. And, you know, they all came through there and played with the house band and Albert Collins. And I got to play with Albert Collins and shot dice with Albert Collins at the night of my bachelor party. And you know, just one night got better than the next. And Austin was a small town back then. It was magic.
Yeah. So you've been here ever since.
Yeah.
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 And you and Kenny Greenberg knew each other, right?
Kenny went and I went to the same high school.
Right. I remember you told me all these things are coming back. I can remember things, David, that are like these facts. Sometimes I go, how did I remember that? This name. But you asked me somebody I met last night or like what time I need to be downstairs in the hotel. Like it's complete blur. You know what I mean?
I have a much better memory of the last 10 years than I do for the previous 10 years, which has a little something to do with changing a couple of my personal habits. But I find, man, it's like that's just part of the era we live in, you know, with the constant distraction,
phones,
Instagram, everything else. It's like just finding time to play guitar. If I'm not at a session or a gig, sometimes, you know, I have every intention of coming out here and practicing. And I never even pick up the guitar because I get distracted. The phone rings.
People texting you, hey, David, can I come over and interview you for this little podcast?
Oh, this is a pleasure, man. This is a pleasure.
Get that gig with Mellencamp, because you were down here, and I remember you telling me another thing. I remember that he wanted you to move to Indiana, and you're like, "Nope, I'm not leaving Austin."
Well, that was at the very end that the order came down that we're not paying any travel expenses. You need to move to Indiana. I mean, my wife had just bought our first house. You know, we weren't even into the we weren't past any interest payments yet, and I'm like, "Well, I don't know about that," but going back to the beginning, when I went to Indiana University thinking I was going to music school, and I did go to music school. I mean, I was took a bunch of music courses for a year, and I realized, man, this is not a guitar environment. And the overlap between the jazz program and the classical program at the time were real. There were some blurred lines there, and I'm not that schooled, and I didn't read well. And it wasn't a good fit, but I met all these guys that just graduated from the School of Music, one of whom was Kenny Aronoff.
Yeah.
And I joined their band, and we toured around the Midwest for a couple of years. And after that band broke up, I worked at a record store there in Bloomington, and John would come in a lot. And that was the first time I met him, but I knew all the guys in his band, and I knew Kenny. Right after I moved down to Austin, I ended up going back up and playing with this guy named Dan Ross, who wrote a song of John's called Play Guitar. John got him to go out and open up his tour. that was sold out, and but he kept it to like 6,000 seat theaters. Really smart, you know. He felt at that point in his life much better to go sell out, have it be a big deal than have 2/3 full arena. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know everybody pretty well there. And then, like 1990, I just get a call out of the blue. Apparently John decided he had some new songs and wanted to go record them. And Larry Crane, one of his guitar players, wasn't available. And they said, can you come up? You want to come up and cut some songs? And I'm like, well, I think I do.
Mm-hmm.
And, went up and did four songs that ended up on his Big Daddy record, and it went well. And I guess a couple months later, John and Larry parted ways, and they just called me and said, do you want to be in the band? Didn't, and there was no audition or anything. Mm-hmm. It was like, jump right into the fire.
Southern Hemisphere, and people are starving. We live right here. And they're tearing down walls in the name of peace. And they're killing each other in the Middle East. Yeah, we love and happiness have forgotten our names. And if the wow you live in love and happiness. Oh,
it's funny, that's sort of a common story I hear from guys I interview, friends that have, you know, big gigs, and it's like, was there an audition? No, I just kind of went in.
I've never gotten a gig from an audition.
Yeah.
Anytime I've ever auditioned, I didn't get the gig.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. I don't know what it is, and it's not, I find that it's word of mouth.
It's exactly,
it's,
man.
Word of
it's
mouth.
All word of mouth, and people, the artist doesn't want to go through cattle call, and it's more work for them.
No.
If you're lucky enough to know people that, you know, are in the,
which is why
world.
Really, I mean, I get people asking me all the time, you know, I get emails on Facebook, man, I just moved to Austin. I'm wondering, I'm looking for a gig. And all I tell them, I mean, all I can say is, are you going out every night? Mm. I mean, you gotta go meet people. You know, and it's like there are no shortcuts. I can't just plug you in if I don't know you. I can't put my, you know, I can't put my reputation on the line and say, hey, you need to hire this guy.
Right.
I don't, even if you send me a CD and you sound great.
You might be a jerk.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
And that's 90% of
it.
It really
is, man.
You know, sometimes.
Nobody wants to hang with, you know,
yeah,
the guy who's an asshole on the bus or really negative. And because that's a lot of, you know, or in the studio is even more revealing, mm-hmm. as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's good advice. Go out, play.
And it's a different environment here now than it was back then. I mean, there were a lot of situations available that I could go sit in more, but really, you know, I really got lucky with the Lucinda thing and then meeting Derek, who really to me is one of the, in terms of blues playing and especially blues rhythm playing and having a grasp of all the different nuances of styles and how to back up a harp player, how to back up a singer, a 5-piece band with a horn section, all these different things, encyclopedic knowledge of the history of blues guitar. Not only did I learn so much from him, but you know, he got me into that scene. And but if I hadn't taken, you know, if I hadn't hung out on the town and made phone calls and gotten loose into thing, none of this would have ever happened.
It's so weird, man. Like one decision you make,
it is,
can totally change the whole trajectory of everything. And you look back 15 years later and you go, how did I meet this? Well, it was through this crappy thing, showcase I didn't even want to do, didn't pay any money, and the harmonica player or something, who I don't even remember, hooked me up with something. And it all,
it's,
you have
true
to be,
man.
Good.
I played gigs in Indiana with Chicken Wire, literally. I mean, and you know, VFWs and in these little bitty towns in Indiana that were like, I'm like, what am I doing in here? This is like, but you know, the best advice I probably have ever gotten was when I was still in high school, I went into a record store. I was in, you know, Karma Records was the place in Louisville. at the time. And I saw this record, and for some reason, it looked like I should buy it. $3.99. It was $3.99. It was Pat Metheny, Bright Size Life. And I heard, and I got this record, and I'm like, it was something that I had, that was so different than anything I'd ever heard. I had no idea what they were doing, but I just knew that somehow deep inside it resonated with me. And I think it was that sort of Midwestern thing, and then Jocko's Magic and the songs. But then I start, and I really got, you know, really into his, into Pat. And again, I couldn't begin to play at that level, but I've always listened to stuff that was definitely above my pay grade and been inspired by it. And I went through this phase of sort of every chance I got going to see him play. And I did a Berkeley summer session 5 weeks when he played every night at the jazz workshop. And I went every night, and I went over to his apartment in Cambridge and
I didn't realize you were a Metheny fan. That's pretty cool.
Took a lesson from him. It was $20.
That's a bro rate right there.
But you know, after all this time, it's sort of like, you know, I was just trying to unlock the secret code.
What kind of stuff did he show you? You remember any of those?
We just played some stuff, and his whole comment at the time was just play more melody. And that was the focus, really. I mean, I couldn't play. It's just like he wanted me to play less, and play more melody when I was soloing. But a couple of years later, back, you know, I always worm my way backstage, and I'm talking to him, and I was at, you know, I'm always asking him questions. He was so patient and generous with his time, and he didn't get like frustrated with me, but he just looked at me and he just said, "Man, just play gigs. Just play gigs." And that was like the best, most succinct advice I ever got. I mean, every crappy hole in the wall, you know, those country gigs with the chicken wire and everything else, because you learn how to deal with people that want to beat you up because you looked at them the wrong way, or you got the wrong haircut. Yeah. You learn how to diffuse
situations.
You learn all these other styles of music you wouldn't have ever mm-hmm. considered investing any time in. And you know, the 5 years I did with Ely, 150, 200 gigs a year, that's when I became a musician, playing gigs.
Yep. Very, very
so, I mean, like, if you're 18, 20, 25, whatever, take every gig. You'll learn more in one gig than you will in a month practicing.
Or a book or something like that.
Yeah. Which you got to do that. I mean, you got to practice and get your thing together, but then you got to go play gigs.
Talk about your style, man. It's really you use these double stops and open strings, and I hear a little bit of Billy Gibbons, Texas in there, but I hear a lot of David Grissom in there. I mean, how did you mesh all those things together?
Well, you know, growing up in Louisville, it wasn't like there was this plethora of bands everywhere, and I just, you know, I would find like one song on a record, or I would hear, I'd go out and hear like a local band, and there would be a great guitar player that, you know, nobody ever heard from again. And it was these little nuggets. Like there were things like I got this, you know, my whole the usual started with, you know, the Stones, then B.B. King and Magic Sam, and then into Wes Montgomery. So I had that progression, but I got into Norman Blake, a bluegrass guitar playing a lot early on. And there was a lot of that going on around Kentucky, obviously. But I got this Norman Blake record called Whiskey Before Breakfast. And that was, you know, I had been playing basically blues rock up to that point. And, you know, the Allman Brothers and kind of mixed with Albert King and some Hendrix. But then I heard Norman Blake, and then I got like a Crusaders record called Chain Reaction that Larry Carlton plays on. And there are like two songs on that record where he solos, not the whole record, but like two solos. And I mean, to this day, that tone and his phrasing and everything, that made a big influence on me. You know, the Beatles song, Gotta Get You Into My Life, there's one lick in that song that really influenced me. My dad listened to Waylon Jennings like almost on a nightly basis. And, you know, I heard Only Daddy That'll Walk the Line, and Wayne Moss plays this guitar solo in it that captivated me. PBS had the greatest unknown guitar player you've ever heard, the special on Roy Buchanan, where he turned it on, and he lost interest in it, and I just was transfixed. You know, I saw Robin Ford and play with Jimmy Witherspoon on soundstage when I was like 15. And his whole jazz phrasing thing over blues, all these little things came together. And I'm leaving some stuff out, but like, you know, even when I'm playing with doing my thing with the amp cranked up, and I mean,
hey, you want me to play? I'll back some. Give me something to play, and you can just demonstrate. What do you want to?
The air conditioner's hitting my.
That's okay, man.
I'm kind of picky about this tuning thing. It's because I found that it.
It definitely sounds better when it's in tune.
I like it when everything's in tune. The hair stands up on my arms just the right way. So, like, even playing like a kind of a blues rock groove, you know. So you keep playing it like, you know, the typical way I would approach, you know, like my first, you know, like I guess the normal first instinct, you know. But when I play that kind of groove, you know, I play. So to me, that right there, that's Norman Blake.
This little thing you did, that little...
I mean, the whole open string thing, you know?
I see.
I mean, it's bluegrass.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Sounds so cool with a, you know, those kind of with distorted...
Yeah.
Kind of that's like seconds and stuff.
That's Norman Blake. I mean,
wow, really?
Bluegrass. That's where that came from to me. And we could talk about open strings for hours, but you know, I was really influenced by Lloyd Maines, who played pedal steel with Ely before I got in the band, that overdriven thing. And then Albert Lee. In particular, on that Dave Edmunds record, Repeat When Necessary, the original version of Sweet Little Lisa.
There's some footage of that on YouTube.
Yeah, and it's not the final solo. But, you know, I've told the story many, many times. I learned the solo off the record. It took me about a year. And then I found out a couple years later he was using a Parsons White B Bender. So I got between Lloyd Maines and that solo, this, you know, the whole pedal steel
thing. And you
thing,
created all your you know, stuff, man.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I'm bending that note with my first finger, and these are 11s,
that's a,
you know?
That's a whole step bend. What are you, in D?
I'm in A. And then when it goes to the leading to the four chord.
Yeah, nice.
You know, and that's a total B string bender thing. But again, the fact that YouTube, you couldn't just dial everything up. Oh, I need to get a B bender guitar. So, you know, the sort of the Heartland Mellencamp thing, the bluegrass thing, the country bands I used to play in, and then that sort of pedal steel approach all just seemed to come together. And then listening to guitar players that played parts and knew how to back up a singer, and then learning how to play with another guitar player. I worked with Brent Mason a lot. Mm-hmm. And obviously on those sessions, he was the chicken picking guy, and I'm more the rock guy. And all those things, it just worked out really well. And Nashville's funny, you know, once you play on a couple records, and if you do well, and maybe a song does well, and every producer in town, I need that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and that worked for about 10 years. And then it's like, there was a bunch of new guys that they needed those guys.
New producers and
new producers.
Everything changes.
Yeah.
You mentioned Lloyd Maines. Now, isn't Lloyd Maines one of the singers of Dixie Chicks? That's her dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
So that was a kind of cool connection later
on.
Because you worked with the Dixie Chicks.
Yeah, I worked with them.
You were their music director, guitar player.
Yeah, band leader for 2-year-long tours. And we did some other one-off tours. And
you and Audley, right? Audley was playing guitar too.
Audley did the second tour.
Yeah.
And which is great. He's a prince.
Yeah,
sweetheart, guy, unbelievable player, total team player. Again, all the right notes, all the right parts, knows when not to lay out, and just so easy to hang with. Just a really beautiful cat. But it was a little bit of a trip playing with Lloyd's daughter, having her be my boss. And Lloyd and I joked about it a lot. He just said, "Hey, Grissom, how does it feel to have my daughter as your boss?" But the Chicks were really fun to work with, and unbelievably talented people. The whole, and then, you know, the whole idea of taking that and putting it in another context with an overdriven tone. And right now we're playing so quiet that our overdrive tones are not as natural as I prefer them to be.
But it sounds great in here, though. It's I'm having to compensate a little bit because of our recording device. But
yeah,
what are you playing through? That's a Marshall 50 watt 72, you said?
Yeah, but I'm just playing through my PRS.
Oh, the PRS
30 watt
it.
Amp, and the master volume is on 1. So it's kind of choked down, but it's still loud.
It's still barking, man. Yeah. It sounds great. And I'm playing through your, what is this, a
Tweed Deluxe? Yeah.
Beautiful amp.
Yeah. Kind of hard to, it's like the Swiss Army knife of.
Yeah.
I've always been a tweed guy, you know, the blackface thing. Like, so many guys rule on blackface Fender amps, and I've just been more of a tweed. I like the extra harmonic content in it. So, you know, when we developed this 30 watt amp, it was like, try to get a hybrid of a Tweed Deluxe and an AC30 and this 50 watt Marshall, basically.
Wow.
It's those three things.
Man, I want to play through that thing before I leave. Check it out.
Yeah, you should. And it also will clean up and do, it will do sort of a black facey thing, but with a little more harmonic action going on in it. And I find that even in the studio, especially with clean tones, if they have just a little bit of, just a little hint of something, you know, saturation, that they translate to tape better, at least the way I play. There's tons of guys that use, I mean, obviously blackface are the standard for so many people, but in the same way, like certain guys like Carver Hayen, or Hayen, I apologize if I mispronounce your name, Carl. I read, you know, he uses 2 AC30s for his clean sound. And if you just barely crank them on, you get this really super rich thing that is clean. And I heard, you know, it's an interesting demarcation point for Tom Petty, because Mike Campbell's one of my favorite guitar players.
Sure.
And I noticed when they went from using AC30s to like little bitty Fender amps, that the guitar tones changed a lot. And it just, I mean, I still love what they do, but the AC30 years were, to me, when it was just like righteous, righteous tone.
I know, I agree. And I heard through a pretty reputable source, although I don't know if it's true, but when I was working with Boz Skaggs, Boz's brother was a guitar tech, and he also worked for Tom Petty. And he told me, I asked him, I said, man, does Mike Campbell have like a wall of AC-30s? He goes, he does, but he's not using anything. He goes, what it is like a little Tweed Deluxe or something in a flight case with one mic on it, and that's the sound you hear in the arena. And that was back, you know, 10 years ago or something, so...
It looked to me like on the latest tour, because I am a huge Petty fan, and I try and Mike Campbell both. I think they're one of the great, truly great American bands with their own thing.
Yep.
And what a great symbiotic partnership between Mike and Tom. It looked like what he was doing to me was like a, some sort of Tweed Deluxe and then a Black Princeton, but running him through some cabinets to get more bottom end and body. Yeah. That's what it looked like. I could be wrong.
Yeah, but, probably so.
You know. I'm really drawn to players that aren't necessarily flashy, that come up with great parts,
hooky parts
and textures. And it's like, you know, Keith Richards, Mike Campbell, John Leventhal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, he's made some of the most exquisite records.
Yeah, I love this.
And those guys have been a huge. Huge influence on me. And Jimmy Page too, you know, the way he arranged guitars for Zeppelin. I'm every bit as enamored, if not more so, especially these days, with the ability to play a great part, come up with a great part, layer and texture guitars. It's just it kind of, I don't know, I'm much more into that than somebody that's just blowing 90 miles an hour, and even no matter how great they are.
Sometimes it's what you don't play.
It is.
You know, I remember the first session I ever got to do with Kenny Aronoff, actually, there was a guy named Paul Franklin who's like the greatest steel player
in the world.
Who
worked with him a bunch.
Yeah, you know Paul Franklin. Yeah. And I was really young and green, and I wanted to impress everybody, and I'm on this session, and nobody would give me the time of day except for Kenny, and Paul was nice. And I remember after like the second day, Paul came up to me and he goes, man, you know what? You're going to do really good. You're a great player. I said, thank you. And he goes, you know why? Because it's what you didn't play all mm-hmm. day. You didn't play hardly anything. You played the right stuff.
Right.
You didn't play. And I was like, wow. Mm-hmm. He goes, yeah, you don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's Brent Mason, and you don't need. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a really big lesson. And when I hear Indeed. Guys like yourself and what you're talking about right now, it just clarifies all of it, man. You know, it's
yeah. And, you know, the whole session thing, as you know, you got to check your ego at the door. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, we hear, like, especially, I mean, I had like a 10-year run in Nashville from 2000 to 2010 where I was getting flown up there two or three times a month to do master sessions. And it was like awesome. Players are so great. But, you know, like the first couple of sessions, on the speed at which it all happens up there blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, but I got with it. And I survived those first couple of sessions and kept getting called back. But, you know, there were so many times when, you know, as you know, you get a guitar vocal thing, you got to come up with the hook, like mm-hmm. now. Like immediately,
or they call it a sig lick,
the signature lick.
Yeah.
You know,
or
you got to have a vibe, or you got to you start playing. And if you have to ask, what are you looking for? You're in the wrong place.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's why you're getting paid. And so many times, I would come up with something that, like, I thought was like badass. And I'm like, how did I come up? You know, and even like, you know, there'd be somebody else in the room going like, yeah, and the producer's like, that's totally not what I'm looking for. I need something else. And the right answer is, I got you. You're right. I hear you. And you come up with something completely different on the spot. And it might happen again. No, try again. I mean, like, it'll come at you like that. Try it again. Like, which is sort of like, you need to get this now. And if you don't get it, you're not going to get called back. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to sort of have, you know, on the spot, come up with three different signature licks is was a product of, you have to do a lot of sessions, gigs. You have to listen to a lot of different kind of music to be able to do that. And, making records is not about us. It's about the song and the artist.
Yeah.
It's important to figure
Unfortunately,
that out.
Unfortunately, it also lends itself to, you know, incestuous sounding records, because you play the same thing, you know, after a while it's like, how creative can you get over four chords, you know, and it's the same formula.
And it's getting much more like that. I hate to, you know, I hate to sound like a curmudgeon or get too cynical about it, but I listen to country radio now, and it's really kind of the trend. And I see it a lot here because I do a lot of this Texas country stuff, and oftentimes a producer will come in and bring sort of a track that he wants, you know,
a reference.
What we're doing it's such a reference track, and sometimes it's kind of hilarious because it'll be 20 beats per minute different, and they've worked out all these kicks and punches, and I get 8 bars of one, you know, and it's like, well, and it's, again, the right answer is cool. I know what you're looking for, you know, and you just make it happen. But there seems to be this songwriting trend now that's sort of been taken from hip hop and more R&B stuff, where the song is two chords, three chords, or even if it's a four chord progression, it never changes.
Right.
First chorus, it never changes.
Well, Tom Petty was criticized, but I kind of thought it was funny as shit, man. He was in New York or something, or no, somebody interviewed him about country music. What do you think of country music? He goes, it's just bad rock with a fiddle. So,
well, what you hear on the terrestrial radio,
The radio,
a lot of that does apply, but I can tell you that, you know, my experience there is that, number one, the session players are bad. Bad to the
absolutely.
Bone. There and are so many amazing songwriters and artists there, and they're starting to break
the talent,
you know, Chris Stapleton.
Pretty ridiculous.
I mean, there are tons of people there that are, and that's one of the beauties of the breakdown of the music business and the new model, is that artists like that, Jason Isbell, who I think is one of my favorite guys out there, songwriting, the way the band sounds, a lot like a young Heartbreakers, you know, they have a sound. Those acts are able to kind of rise through the bureaucracy or the net,
right?
The filter that sort of kept decided who's cool and who's not.
Well, you want to play something?
Yeah, sure.
Let's see. What can I comp for you? Something.
We can play. We could play like a you know, like a slower funky thing, or maybe
sure.
Just
you
like,
kick something off, man.
Just like, so. Let's just do this thing like in C sharp.
C sharp. All right.
The Spanish Castle magic chord. So like 8 bars, you know. Bars of that,
okay,
and then like a B section, F sharp minor 7, E over G sharp, A.
Okay.
Then to B the second time.
Okay, let me make sure I'm in tune now.
Thank you.
Fun little jam.
Yeah, I like playing, and it's kind of cool, you know, all the open string thing. Again, it's like the having the flat 7, the B, as mm-hmm. the open string. And
Yeah. That's a cool chord.
Spanish Castle Magic.
Yeah, that one, or what's the other one? It's Taxman, if you put the third in there.
7+9?
Or, yeah. Or is that Josie? I mean, it's like a couple of things. You know, you could... Just like a regular Mel bass C7 chord, C sharp. With the
yeah.
I like that voicing too. Tell me about your new records and stuff you've been working on. I mean, I've kind of lost touch with what you've been up to.
I've done 4 CDs on my own, and I'm working on a 5th one at the moment. It's kind of been going really slow. I haven't had a good run of sessions lately.
Yeah, what were you working on in L.A.?
I did a Rita Coolidge record
out there,
which was like so, you know, it was really old school. We worked at Sunset Sound.
Oh, I love that place.
Bob Glaub played bass, and this great drummer, Brian McLeod. And the days of working in the studio like that and taking a whole day to do 2 tracks, I mean, it's like that doesn't ever happen anymore, but... It was great. Rita was super cool. The producer, Ross Hogarth, picked some great songs. Other than the one I wrote, she did cut one of my songs a song I wrote with Chris Stapleton.
Wow, and, nice, man.
Which is always exciting. And
that's got to be cool, being on a session and playing one of your own songs that you know is going to be on the record.
Yeah, it was really special and really fun. It was one of those sort of... it's kind of a ballad, and so the first verse and chorus it's like, you know, 62 beats per minute, and it's all acoustic, me playing acoustic guitar. It's a real pucker moment, you know. It's with, you know, as you know, it's way harder to pocket things slower. It's much harder to play slower, which is so counterintuitive to what, as kids, we think. We practice with the metronome to play fast. And it's the slow stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, with all that space. But
what do you do when you go to LA to do sessions? Do you have gear there?
Borrowed stuff.
Call friends and borrow some guitars.
Yeah, the producer had a bunch of stuff. PRS sent me some things. Pete Thorne and Tim Pierce were so nice to lend me some stuff. So it's a little bit, you know, I love having all my stuff, but you make do with whatever. I mean, I can, you know, if PRS sends me a guitar and an amp and I bring a pedal board, I can do 90% of the record that way.
Yeah. Make it work, man.
Yeah.
Your hands. Bring your hands.
It really is. I wish it was all about the gear and then we could all be there. But I mean, it's the eternal debate. I do find that, you know, the right gear does have a lot to do with being able to translate with what I hear in my head. But at the end of the day, you know, the first thing I do when I do a clinic or a workshop is take my guitar and walk around the room, my electric guitar, not plugged in, and let the people hear, you know, what it sounds like without an amplifier.
Yeah, it's really spanky. It's got a lot of volume.
You've got to make the sound, you know, with your hands. The pickups are just a microphone on a singer, as Paul Reed Smith says, and so...
I have a Paul Reed Smith. I play it sometimes. I don't know the model. I think it's an early 90s one, or maybe a 93 or so. I changed the pickups years ago and put Gibson pickups. A friend of mine named Nick did it for me years ago.
Yeah, they make really consistently good guitars, and I've had a signature model since 07 with them. But I've played the guitars forever.
We did a gig in Baltimore and you introduced me to Paul Reed Smith.
Yeah.
He was there at the gig.
Yeah. And so I've had the good fortune to work with Paul, tweaking the guitars and designing some stuff. And so the guitar that I ended up the guitar that's my signature model is by far the most vintage-inspired guitar they make. And
I'm looking at this other one down here. Is that an older one?
That's the prototype for my signature. Okay. We made two, one with a stop tail and one without.
Man, that's beautiful. Gold
this,
top.
So this is a prototype that's, I think, tuned to open G, which I use tunings constantly.
Songwriting spurs some different ideas and things.
Songwriting and sessions. I mean, when I do sessions, I'm always thinking three parts in my head. You know, how am I going to sort of arrange? Because I know they're going to want me to. You get the track, and then I stay out there and put on another guitar part, and I'm thinking ahead, and I found that between baritone guitars, open tunings, and capos, I can cover a really wide range of things. And one thing I do quite a bit is, I mean, I'll do, for instance, it just depends on the song, and you listen to the chorus and the influences, the riff you want to come up with. But it's like playing in the key of E to me has become so cliched and boring that oftentimes I'll take a baritone guitar and tune it or capo it to where I'm playing out of the G position, or I'll tune it to open E, or I'll take a guitar that's tuned out of step and play out of F sharp just to try to get something different than the stock. I mean, open strings are such a huge part of what I do, but I mean, the key of E, I don't know. It's just like a big embossed invitation to cliches.
Yeah. Well, there's only so many things you can
do. Which is crazy kind of because there's plenty you can do in any, but on guitar, it's easy to fall, in the idiom that I play in, it's easy to fall back into certain things.
You know what? Remember one day you were telling me that you did a session with Ringo Starr. What was that like? It was a Kenny Aronoff hookup or something you were telling me?
But... Yeah, I was touring with Mellencamp. And it was 91, I remember, because I do remember specifically. And we were staying at the Bel Air Hotel, which is the nicest hotel I think I've ever stayed at. And Don was called Kenny and said, hey, is your guitar player available today? And we had a day off.
Ah, perfect.
And Kenny was doing sessions nonstop on the tour with John. And John was like getting ticked off about it. And Kenny was like, well, bro, Don Was wants to know if you can get over to Conway. And I like took a cab over there and took one guitar. I didn't even have a pedal board at that point. I mean, with Mellencamp, I used a TC Electronics booster.
Uh-huh.
And I'd go do a session and everything would be strewn across the floor or whatever. But they rented some amps. I brought my acoustic guitar and electric guitar. So I get there and it's Mike Landau, Hutch Hutchinson, and I can't remember. There was probably a keyboard player and me. And so I found out all of a sudden I'm playing acoustic guitar. And we tracked, I think, three songs that day, and Ringo cut live with us.
Oh, wow, and, man. I mean, that's ironic that a drummer gets you the call and then he's not even on the session and it's Kenny Aronoff.
Yeah, it's Kenny, but it's a Ringo record. Yeah. And so I'm like sitting in the booth looking straight at Ringo in that Silver Pearl Ludwig kit, thinking this is just like Star Trek. So I just got beamed into this room.
Just like the Lucinda thing in New Orleans, man.
It
like
is,
another chapter.
Or playing with the Allman Brothers. I mean, standing next to Greg Allman, playing Dreams and, amazingly cool experiences that I'm so grateful to have been able to do. But you never thought in a million years I'd be playing acoustic guitar on a Ringo record. But he was really cool, really gracious. I did one song, I doubled what I played, and he walked out into my booth and said, let me shake the hand of the man that played that perfect acoustic guitar part. And I'm just the whole
nice
time I'm just
say.
Like trying not to germ him, 40 million questions. And but it was really cool.
Nice, man. That's, I've never played a Ringo, but I've had some memories where you pinch yourself moments, a lot of them, it dilutes the lows, because it's like what we do is like sometimes it's extreme highs and lows.
It is. You know? But my friend Greg Morrow, one of the top, you know, one of the best drummers I've ever played with and one of the main guys in Nashville, his quote is, even when it sucks, it's great. And I think that's a great attitude to have. It's, but yeah, man, you know.
Just like right now, we're sitting at your place. If you would have told me back in whenever it was, 98 or whenever we were hanging out, like, man, you know what? You're going to be in town with Hall & Oates.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be like, we'll hang and like you can come over and you're going to do this thing called a podcast. I'd be like, what?
I know. It's crazy.
You don't know.
I mean, we're still doing it. I don't know. It's like every day I wake up, I'm like, I can't believe that this is what I've done my whole life, you know?
And not only that, you're very well known and respected for it. It's not like, you know, you're like, even as beautiful as it is just to play music for a living as an, quote, anonymous kind of cat, it's even better that, you know, you're known for your thing, you know?
I've put myself in situations and lucked into situations where I've been allowed to sort of grow and find my thing. And that is not to be, you know, there is an element of luck involved in. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, somehow it's sort of surreal. And I mean, I've done four records with Buddy Guy, you know, like how did that happen? I know guys, I mean, like there are 15 people in Austin that are better, more authentic blues players than me. But, you know, again, that's not necessarily what, you know, having the luck to have done this broad range of styles, you know, I get called to do that. And yeah, I know how to play I understand the music, but I can expand on it and adapt. And right. I think that's a lot of what really sums up what a session player has to be able to do.
Right. Well, real quick, I'm playing through for the gear heads, which I never do this and I always forget. This pedal I'm playing through, what is it? You let me play through one of your pedal boards, the Jetter, Grissom Jetter.
Yeah.
And you're playing through one too.
Yeah, I don't have it turned on because I mean, my amp is in the other room.
It's a cool sound.
It's an overdrive that is sort of in between, like it's a clean boost and a tube screamer, you know, where tube screamer-ish kind of, those types of distortions to me have always like removed bottom
and boosted
mids. And then I'm always turning the tone control almost all the way off. And so this, I like about this is that it keeps all your low end and then you can dial the gain back, you know, to where it's barely adding any gain at all. So
I noticed that because I had to actually add some highs to it.
And you can take like, it's an amazing pedal that I've found. And one thing that has been really useful, and I think you're kind of doing that now, is like when you have to play super quiet, I could take a Blackface Deluxe and turn it up to 2 and then use that pedal just to put harmonic richness into it and a little overdrive, not make it any louder, but that, and just for that alone, it's fantastic. But
yeah, that sounds great, man.
Yeah. Very musical. Brad Jetter is really, really doing great stuff. And that was one of the main things we did was dial back the gain. But if you turn it all the way up, or the taper on the gain pot, if you turn the gain all the way up, you're going to get a lot of gain. But I prefer to be able to.
So it's sort of subtle first half, and then it goes up.
Then
like
it goes
exponential
up a
more.
A lot, curve. But the way I set my amps up is that when I turn down and play softer, it's a clean tone, and when I turn all the way up and play hard, it sort of starts to crunch. So I don't need tons of gain added.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, that's why, like on some boards, I have a clean boost and 2 different overdrive pedals. And I've been, you know, sometimes I turn 2 of them on at once if I just prefer that to the channel switching amps. It works better for me.
Well, I think we covered a lot of stuff, David. You know, man.
I'll talk.
That's
your
cool.
Ear off.
I wish I had more time. I have to go. I want to, if you have time, we'll grab lunch.
Let's
and
do.
I have to go do a sound check. But, man,
you
I
get
feel
to
like
go
I've
do
waste...
a sound check.
Yeah, I get to go. It's it's not like I don't want to do it. It's just
what were you
I'd rather hang here with you and, you know, talk shit about guitars.
Yeah,
stuff.
We haven't even gotten to acoustic guitars and old guitars.
I feel
I got
like
a
we
bunch
just
of
warmed
stuff
up.
Around here
I just warmed up.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, you got like killer, man, wow. Look at this collection.
I got some, nice. You know, oddly enough, I don't consider myself to be a great acoustic player, but I do play on records a lot, and I've probably got more cool old acoustic guitars than electrics.
Yeah, those are sweet too, man. They're like,
it's hard to, some of these cases aren't the correct cases, but there's some neat stuff in here.
Yeah, I see your ukulele thing. I got one of those too from True Fire, and I'm still trying to figure out what to use it on. I've messed with some tunings on it.
That sounds good.
I know, I like this.
I mean, like, we're talking over that.
I can pull and get like a single. So. Sounds good with the single.
I'm gonna plug into this amp.
Yeah. Well, I think we got plenty. And thank you so much, David, for your time.
It's been great, man.
Yeah.
So nice to see you. Have a relaxed chat about
relaxed chat and jam, little jam
music.
And, well, if you have time, we'll grab lunch. So thanks for listening, and yeah, I guess that's it.
Adios.
There you have it. If you're still here, I hope you enjoyed that one. Thanks so much for listening. Love your comments, reviews. Take care. See you next time. And if you're interested, stay tuned. There'll be the little jam, playing through his pedal board at the end of this, of David's pedal board, just trying out some things. All right. Take care.
It just pulls right. And I'll turn it up for you.
Okay. Now I'm plugging into the PRS amp. Like it gets stopped up and then it's just
that's really loud. I'm just
no, it's not that. It's just no, it's lately it's been
machine. It has a nice ramp. I mean, there's like a million of those things out there, but I just...
Nothing like playing through a 412, man.
Yeah, I know.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.